Welcome to Sci-Fi On Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo, and today we're going to be talking about David Cronenberg's 1981 film, Scanners. So, brief background on Cronenberg. He's had a very long career. It's kind of broken up into two phases. He was making movies in the early and mid-70s. He started making really low-budget horror movies, The Brood and Rabid. Then, in the early 80s, he hit on what I call, the period of films that I think are his best, 1981 Scanners, Videodrome, The Dead Zone, and The Fly. And then he went on after that to make Dead Ringers, Naked Lunch, Crash, and Existence in 1999. And then he kind of shifted into a different style with 2002's film Spider. And then after that, History of Violence, Eastern Promises, Dangerous Method, Cosmopolis, Maps to the Stars. He went very straight and he just left the genre. Existence was his last genre film. A good friend of mine actually put it perfectly where he said, you know, Cronenberg is a terrific B-movie director. Was born to make B-movies. Since 2002, he's been trying to make A-films, but to me, he has a B-movie director's skills and pathos. And I don't know, I haven't really liked his later career. I found the films very programmatic and kind of dull. In the early 80s, he made some dynamite films, so I'll probably cover The Dead Zone and The Fly in other podcasts as well. So with that said, let's get into Scanners. So the film begins with basically straight-up opening credits on a black screen and this very dramatic music. The music was done by Howard Shore, and I really like this film music. It's definitely not for all tastes. It can be wonky at times and very 80s-ish, lots of synth sounds, but I think it has a real power in certain parts of the film. But it's a little over the top in the opening credits. You know, it's a little much, but I think it gets better as it goes. So the film opens proper in some kind of a mall sort of eating area, and we track this guy walking in, and he's kind of shabbily dressed, and he looks kind of out of it completely. The character's name, and I'll call him by his character name, which we find out later, but his name is Cameron Vale, and he is the protagonist of the film, played by an actor named Stephen Lack. So we hear some really eerie music. He comes in and sits down at a table, and obviously definitely someone who lives on the streets or close to the streets, begins to look around on tables and to eat, sort of pick up uneaten food off of other people's plates and, you know, eat it for himself. This is obviously, you know, how he survives. These two women are sitting at a table nearby, and they're watching him, completely disgusted by it. You know, they start whispering to each other, and you hear what they're saying really quietly, blah, 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 how disgusting this man is. Cameron Vale turns around, and obviously he can hear what they're saying. All of a sudden, we're not really sure what's going on, but the woman starts to, she stops talking, and she's in some kind of distress, and the music soundtrack cues up, and we realize that Vale is doing something to her with his mind. The music cues up to such a level that it becomes almost like a montage sequence where you're cutting back and forth, and the woman goes into convulsions as she sort of falls off the chair, is on the ground flopping around as Vale is doing what he's doing to her. Now, one thing to note in this opening sequence is Cronenberg's choices. He doesn't do the scene straight. He does it very impressionistically. It's almost a montage, the way it's filmed. The music comes up, and we cut back and forth between Vale and the woman flopping around. And you know exactly what's going on, but the music is queued up to such a degree that it becomes much more impressionistic, and it's quite effective, actually. It makes me sit up and pay attention to what's going on in the film, because I realize now I have a director who is in command of all the tools at his disposal and is not shy to, you know, put a scene forward in a slightly different way than a naturalistic film would. And I dig that. At some point, Vale stops his mental attack, but he's noticed by two men in trench coats who close in on him and chase him up an escalator. And there's a bit of a brief chase scene when he's running from them, and then they pull out a weapon and shoot him with some kind of tranquilizer dart, and he eventually collapses. Next scene, Vale wakes up, and he's been bathed and dressed in a white shirt and white pants, lying on a cot, and he is restrained. There's no dialogue, and he's approached by an older man with a beard and glasses. And the character in the film's name is Dr. Paul Ruth, and he's played by none other than Patrick McGoohan, who's one of my personal favorite actors of all time. McGoohan's first big role was as Danger Man, which was a spy series in the 60s in the UK. And then he did what's now the iconic and series that everybody probably knows him most from is The Prisoner. I think it was a 17-episode series on BBC, which another personal favorite of mine. He was in, you know, a decent amount of films, most notably Ice Station Zebra, Escape from Alcatraz with Eastwood. Then most people may remember him, if they haven't known him from The Prisoner, as Edward I in Braveheart, in Mel Gibson's Braveheart. And McGoohan censors this film in an extremely powerful way. He's a terrific actor. In a sense, McGoohan does for Scanners what Alec Guinness sort of does for Star Wars, where early on in Star Wars, when Guinness shows up, he, to me, elevates the whole film, gives it an extra center of gravity that I think is very subtle, but extremely effective. Not to compare Star Wars with Scanners, obviously. So in extremely pared-down dialogue, Dr. Paul Ruth walks up to Vale and he says, "You're a scanner, and the cause of your wasted life," because he's basically been, you know, a wastrel up until now, I guess we're told, "is the fact that you are this thing called a scanner, but it can also be a source of power." And then he walks away, doesn't say anything else, and we don't know what the hell's going on, which is terrific. And then the soundtrack cues up some eerie music. Dr. Ruth starts bringing in all of these people to simply sit around Cameron on this bed, and there's maybe two or three dozen people. And as they're coming in, we can sort of hear their voices as if it was a voiceover soundtrack, and we get a sense that Cameron is hearing all these voices in his head, and he starts to kind of freak out. He's struggling against the restraints more and more as the voices are there in his head, and he seems to not be able to do anything about it. The way it's shot, we realize that they were probably there for several days. And I think the best that Vale can do is to kind of take the voices down to a kind of a muted roar. And they do this with the sound as well. It's really kind of neat. All the voices start to blend together, which is kind of his internal filter is brought to bear. And at some point, Ruth sits down and injects him with a substance. And we kind of get a sense on camera that all the voices have died down because of what he's been injected with. So we cut it right away to the exterior of a building. And the sign in front of it says CONSEC. There's some kind of seminar going on, and what we quickly learn is a self-proclaimed scanner, this gentleman sitting there in glasses, is about to demonstrate scanning techniques. And he tells the assembled group of people that people being scanned can suffer from symptoms such as nosebleeds and nausea and so on and so forth. And so he calls for volunteers, and we see the people sitting there. They look like in some kind of industry, possibly because of the sign in front of the building, the defense industry. And we see a man holding up his hand, and he's none other than Michael Ironside, who plays a character named Daryl Revok, who in the film, we don't know his name yet. He's just some guy. And Michael Ironside has been a character actor, tough guy, sort of bad guy character actor in film for a long time. Most recently, he was in Terminator Salvation as General Ashdown. He was in X-Men First Class as the admiral in charge of the fleet near the end of the film. I remember him the most as Richter from Total Recall. He's been in a ton of movies, and he's been in like probably half of the films he's been in are these direct-to-video, terrible action and sci-fi knockoff films. So the man works a lot. I like him, and he's a very intense actor, and I think he does really well in this film. Revok sits down next to the guy, the demonstrator, and then they have this kind of... Then we get a sense that the scanning is starting to happen. What happens is the guy who's demonstrating the scanning techniques looks more and more uncomfortable, and Daryl Revok looks relaxed. The music really starts to wind up. Just weird little pockets of skin sort of flex on Revok's face, and slowly the music winds up and winds up. And the demonstrator is in intense despair. His head is shaking. His hands are coming up. He's twitching. It's a creepy scene. And Revok more and more just looks really relaxed. His eyes are closed. He's kind of flexing his neck. And then in a moment when we think he can't get more intense, the demonstrator's head explodes in a bloody mess. And just, you know, a quick aside, this is one of the most indelible scenes, I think, in horror movie history. It's an amazing scene. It builds well. It comes out of nowhere. It just happens, and it's creepy and gross. And actually, I have to give a lot of credit to the actor playing opposite Ironside, because he really does a hell of a job, seemingly completely helpless and then stuck and then frightened and then in terror, realizing that he's been taken control of by another scanner. And it's an incredible scene. The security personnel that are in the room sort of gather around and they grab Revok. They drag him out of the room, and at some point they're bringing him down a stairwell. They get him to the ground, and someone says to the doc, "Give him a shot of ephemeral." We don't know what that is yet. And the doctor leans down, and he's about to inject Revok's hand, but Revok looks at him, and you can tell that he's somehow trying to take control of him. And there's a brief struggle. The doctor injects himself right next to Revok's hand, and you know, no one can tell but Revok and the doctor what exactly happened. Next, we cut to there are two sets of cars driving on the street. It's a rainy evening. They have Revok in one of the cars held down, and we can see him there. And we hear the guys talking that they're going to be taking him to some undisclosed location, obviously torture him and you know, try to get some information out of him. And you know, the head of the security team is there, this one guy who's there with him. And at one point, we get the sense that Revok is taking control of the driver of the chase car. So the car speeds up, goes past the car that they're all being held hostage in, and basically drives into a wall, explodes. The car Revok is in stops. The two guys in the front get out. They try to see if they can pull the guy out of the car. They can't. Revok then takes control of the guy who's still in the car with him. The guy pulls out a gun, shoots the other two guys, and then shoots himself. So then we cut back to a briefing room. We're back at the CONSEC building, and a bunch of executives are sitting around a table, and they're talking about what happened the previous evening. And one of the guys is saying, you know, the first time we decided to reveal the existence of scanning techniques to the world, it ended in 6 people dead. When the camera pulls out and widens, we see Dr. Paul Ruth sitting at the edge of the table. So he's part of this CONSEC group. And we see a gentleman by the name of Keller, who's the new security chief they've brought in since the guy last night was killed by Revok. He's basically saying that, you know, we really need to veer away from this whole scanner thing. It's ridiculous. And Ruth comes back at him, basically saying, this scanner got in past your security screening, killed all these people and got away, you know, using scanning techniques. You know, are you crazy? The guys at the table are talking about Paul Ruth's scanner program. And Ruth says, you know, what this must mean is that there's a more advanced program out there that's like way ahead of us. And, you know, they're targeting scanners on our list and either recruiting them or killing them. Sort of a scanner underground. And Roth knows about Revok. And he says, you know, there's a guy who's leading this underground. His name is Dalla Revok. And he won't stop until, you know, he takes control of pretty much everything. So now we cut back to the sort of abandoned warehouse / lab where Cameron Vale is. And he's talking to Dr. Paul Ruth. Because he's been injected with ephemeral, Val, actually for the first time, probably in his life, feels somewhat sane. And there's this great notion where Ruth says, you know, how could you hear your own voice without all these other voices drowning out? For the first time, Val can hear himself. What I love about B-movies, and this one particularly, is that it does play with some themes that I find interesting. It doesn't take them in and make it, you know, a more unified experience. But it just throws them out there as themes to be, you know, part of this film. And I really like that. So we get a brief bit of exposition about what scanners are. And what Ruth says is that scanners are humans born with a certain level of ESP. And the drug that was injected into Vale was called ephemeral. And somehow it suppresses scanning activity. So, you know, his ability to hear all these voices. And we find out later to actually project power into other people is dampened by ephemeral. It's a nice little, very economical and cool scene. We're watching Ruth and Val talk. And then in the next scene, we sort of backed out and we're watching that same conversation on a camera. And the new security director of CONSEC, Keller, is watching them on the screen, obviously covertly. Possibly not, but he picks up a phone and basically makes an appointment, and the music cue is such that we already know that, like, Keller's no good. So next, Ruth shows Vale some early footage when Dalla Revok was captured and in an insane asylum. And it's this whole sequence is so creepy and really good. We have a young Revok who has a bandage like on his in and around his eyes on his forehead, and there's a little eye sort of drawn on the middle of it. And what we get is that he tried to drill a hole in his head, and the woman sitting opposite him is asking him all these questions. You know, why did you try to drill a hole in your head, Daryl? And you know, he's saying to let out the voices, and he drew a third eye on the front. You know, so the voices know he's awake and maybe they won't come back in. But it's done in like an old style, maybe 50s, you know, film stock, making it look very realistic, you know, that this was footage actually, you know, filmed in the 50s when, you know, Revick was captured. And Ironside is great, man. He's dangerous and unpredictable. He has a definite power about him. And there's one point when he drains a glass of water and then throws it. The woman kind of knows that he's losing it. She bails out of the room before that. But, you know, he's kind of a nut, you know, back, and he was 22 years old at the time. Once she leaves the room, he comes up close to the camera, pulls off the bandage, and we see the actual hole where he tried to drill into his head. And very creepy scene. Of course, Vale sees this and he's like blown away. He's like, oh my God, I totally understand this guy. I get it. And Ruth right away is trying to steer him away from empathy, where he says, look, this is a very bad guy. There's a line where he says he used to be a danger to himself. Now he's just a danger. And basically, he's going out into the world, finding scanners, giving them the opportunity to join his organization. And if they turn him down, he kills them. Then we also get a sense from Ruth that he thinks scanners can actually possibly be the first, you know, group of human beings who could really affect positive change in the world if they use their powers to sort of bring people together and to connect. And so we kind of get a sense of what Ruth's goals are on this thing. There's a brief scene where Keller is walking down and he sits in a subway waiting platform, and, you know, I guess he's either hands over a briefcase or is given a briefcase, I forget. But he's talking to a man who we don't know. I think the voice fairly well identifies him as Revick, telling Revick basically that they found some new guy, and, you know, Ruth's going to send somebody after you. And so we know now for sure that Keller is on Revick's paybook, and he is the mole, the bad guy. Then there's this great scene. Ruth wants to try to help Vale control his powers. So in the lab, the abandoned building where they're staying, he gets a yogi to sit down with Cameron. What he tells him is that this yogi has the power to control his heartbeat. So the yogi can bring his heartbeat up or down by using his mind. And what he wants Cameron to do is to push the yogi's heartbeat up as much as he can until, you know, Ruth tells him to stop. And then at that point, the yogi will take back over control of his heart and bring it down. But the cool idea we get here is that, and again, it elevates this film from just another schlocky film, is that there's been some thought put into this. What Ruth says is that what scanners can do is to connect their nervous system. He defines telepathy as the linking of two nervous systems separated by space. So basically, scanners can control bodies of other people. They can control their hearts, other things in their body. So, you know, where we have our autonomous nervous system, which controls our body, a scanner can interrupt that link and replace the link with themselves, actually control parts of your body with the signals that they're generating from their nervous system, and, you know, joining nervous systems. It's a great idea because, you know, what's normally ESP? ESP is normally presented as like people who can read minds, and telekinesis being, you know, I can force objects to move from their own will. But this is just another level of, and it's genius. They explore it later on with another couple of things. So it's really cool. And I'm, you know, at this point I'm watching the movie and I'm thinking, no, this is a great idea. And this is someone who's not just tossing off a shitty film. Like, he put a lot of thought into how this world works, and it's really neat. Vale starts to push his heart up, and at one point, it's so high that you can tell the yogi's in distress, and Paul Ruth tries to get him to stop, and he doesn't stop, and he's about to inject him with ephemerol, but then Vale grabs Ruth's hand and holds it, and he finally releases the yogi, who comes back down, and his heartbeat comes back. Vale looks at him and basically says, "You're right, Doc. It was really easy." And in that moment, we're like, whoa, that was kind of creepy. And does this guy have the potential to be a megalomaniac? The one Achilles heel in this film, and it's a shame, is the actor playing Cameron Vale is terrible. I don't think you could come up with too many more superlatives than terrible. He's a horrible actor. He's a guy, this guy, Stephen Lack. I mean, yes, he lacks quite a lot. What keeps this movie squarely in B category and doesn't push it out into anything else is this man's performance. It's so bad, and you know, it keeps Scanners in the midnight movie category because it's hard to believe that Cronenberg would allow this kind of performance to make it to film. I mean, it's that bad. But the movie around him is so compelling that I do return to it from time to time. But man, the lead actor is really a stinker. Vale now goes out on his first mission, and Paul Ruth basically tells him, they found this artist who makes art where, you know, you get a sense that from the art that either he's a scanner or that he knows scanners because of the type of art that he makes, which is kind of cool. sort of betrays that he may have knowledge of scanning. Vale goes to his gallery, and you know, the interesting thing about this sequence is that there's some really cool pieces of art in this gallery. And one that jumps out of me, there's a sculpture of a man with a dozen or two red strings coming out of his head and going upwards, and above him, as if against the wall, are like a dozen skulls in like bas-relief coming out of the wall. And obviously, it's sort of a notion of, you know, people inside this guy's head. And if he wasn't a scanner or didn't know scanners, how would he be even coming up with this idea? And yet, at the same time, it is a cool, I mean, it's a cool idea on its own. You know, when I was watching this film, I more and more started to get the sense that you could really make the analog that this is like a drug addict, like a scanner is kind of a drug addict, in that he needs to escape from what the scanner perceives are these voices that he cannot control. It's very much like a drug addict and emotions. You know, take the analog instead of voices in the head, emotions or the feelings, certain feelings that, you know, where a drug addict will be beset by these negative emotions and not knowing how to control them or what they are drives the drug addict to go out and drink or take, you know, inject themselves with substances and sex addiction and all kinds of stuff, shopping, you know, you name it. So underneath here is a really cool idea in terms of what a scanner is dealing with does have a toe in universal human stuff, you know, like it's kind of the stuff that people deal with, the stuff that's you feel like you can't control, that's intruding into your life. And what do you do about that, you know? So anyway, I mean, I like genre films because I like metaphor, and I think metaphor is a really powerful way to get ideas across. I'm not a big fan of our current literalist, artistic, you know, zeitgeist that we're in where everything is on the nose. I love metaphor, and you know, I love genre and B movies because they truck more in metaphors than most straight stuff does. I don't know. I find it that it magnifies what I'm watching and makes me think, and I like it. So Vale confronts the art dealer who manages this guy named Pierce, and he says, "Oh, I want to buy a piece, but of course I got to meet the artist." And the guy says, "Well, it's impossible. He doesn't meet people." And Vale does a little scanning thing on him, and the guy's nose starts to bleed. He basically says, you know, think of where he lives. And then at one point, the guy goes off, and then Vale's standing there, and a woman appears who knows the dealer, and she looks at Vale, and she scans him. We can tell that Vale's being scanned, and he's kind of surprised by it. And then he looks over where the woman is supposed to be. She's gone. We cut right to Vale at Pierce's artist's loft out somewhere in sort of the countryside. And Vale enters the room and Pierce is there. Right when he comes in, then we cut exterior and we see a van that pulls up behind his car. And these four gunmen get out. Like, it's a one woman and three men. And they start to converge on the house. And there's a great music cue that comes up. Again, very creepy. We see some pieces that are being worked on in Pierce's workshop, which are very cool. There's this huge skull on its side, and Vale and Pierce go inside the skull to have this conversation. Again, inside the skull, it's like couches, and again, it's another cool piece of art, which is kind of connected to what it's like to be a scanner. Vale asks Pierce, like, how do you deal with the voices? And Pierce says, I make art. You know, it saves my life. And then Pierce is like, you know, you're full of shit. Pierce basically accuses Vale of lying, and when he says he wants to find Al Revick, Pierce leaves the skull, and the gunmen are inside already, and they open up on him with shotguns and kill him. And it's a kind of a goofy scene because they all miss. It takes like six or seven shots to bring this artist down. It's very weird. Then Vale inside realizes what's going on. He takes control of all of them from inside this skull, basically incapacitates them. Walks up to Pierce at that point. Pierce is just about to die, and he thinks of a name, Kim Obrist. You hear it being said over and over inside of his head, and we realize that Vale has heard him. So now Vale's back at this hotel. He gets a package, and it's it's ephemeral. So he's sitting in the hotel room, and you're from his point of view, which is what we're looking at, the voices are everywhere. And so he injects himself with ephemeral, the voices die down again, and he's able to get to sleep. And there's great audio effects of all the voices in his head and how they kind of blur together. Like, it's very creepy. The sound design on this film and the soundtrack has this wonky moments, but great attention is paid to sound in this film. again, even, you know, when you see Vale in the hotel room, like, there's been no real character development of his main character. Cameron Vale is just a cipher. He has an empty shell cipher character, which really, again, is another reason why Scanners is, you know, squarely in the B-movie category. Vale's very, first of all, he's played by a very uninteresting and untalented actor. And then the character itself of Cameron Vale is just like a non-character. He's really just a protagonist in a film that needs one, you know, so that's why he's there. So Vale goes to Kim Obrist's house, and he finds her and this sort of underground group of scanners who are not with Revick. They're sort of like, you know, as soon as he gets there, it's very similar to when he arrived at the artist's house. You get an exterior shot. Revick has followed him there, and now he's sort of programming with his mind his killers to go up there and just basically kill everybody. At some point, the scanners with Vale, they sort of do this scan ceremony where they scan with each other together. When they do the scan together, it's like, it's very relaxing and very, you know, they're communing and using scanning techniques to bring each other closer together and kind of unify their personalities. And you get a sense of the potential of this group and what they, you know, what Ruth was talking about in terms of scanners being able to, you know, change the world for the better. Like, they demonstrate a little bit of this here. Like, they're using scanning techniques to bring together, possibly to heal, to connect people, whereas, of course, Revick is purely using them for control and domination. So because they're kind of in this scanning trance, the gunmen are able to kind of come upon them with ease, and they kill several of the scanners before the combined scanners, who actually are very powerful, and they even say it when they combine themselves together, they're much more powerful than a single scanner. And they wind up lighting these two gunmen on fire. And you haven't seen that technique before for scanners. You know, you've seen them control things, but not cause combustion. It's very cool in that moment. And it makes sense because there are more of them. They can channel more power, and that you would see a new versions of technique from them. So now they're driving. There's about five or six of them left, and they've escaped. But this security van pulls up right next to them and opens up and basically blows them all away. The van crashes into a storefront and catches on fire. And basically, Cameron and Kim are the only survivors of this whole group. They've all been killed. They make their way out of the bus and down into the basement of the building where they rest. However, we see one of Revick's gunmen enter the store and kind of look around. And he gets a sense of their trail and follows them down into the basement. And while they're sitting there, he sort of arrives with a shotgun. He's about to kill them, but Vale grabs control of him with his scanning power. He and Kim force him to his knees, and basically he forces the guy to give up any kind of link to Daryl Revick, and he pulls out this vial, which we've seen before, which is ephemeral, and it has a corporate logo on it. And the next shot is to a building with that corporate logo and the name of the company, Bicarbon Amalgamated. Is the name of the company. It's a chemical company. Very economical film, and I'll get more into that in the summary. But boy, it's just shot for shot for shot, you're moving the story forward. Boom, 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 you know. Very fast moving. So now you're inside Bicarbon Amalgamated. Some time has passed because we see Cameron there working in one of these large white suits, and we see these tankers and workers, and, you know, they're manufacturing bulk chemicals. And from Vale's point of view, he looks up and now he sees Daryl Revick standing in one of sort of the control areas, signing some papers. And so we know now that he's found Revick. Revick leaves and Vale goes up to this control area. He basically queries the computer, which seems completely absurd. This is the one moment where it seems ridiculous because, you know, this guy was basically street trash most of his life. And now he's able to, you know, log into sensitive computers at an industrial site and pull information out. So it's a misstep, unfortunately, by Cronenberg. But we do get some information, and there's something going on at the plant called Project RIPE, R-I-P-E. When Vale tries to access further information, of course, he's blocked. So he calls Ruth, and he says, I found someone who worked inside Revick's organization. I want to be brought in. So he kind of lies to Ruth, because Kim did not work in there. We cut briefly to Keller and Revick sitting in the same bench in the subway, and Revick basically says, look, if Paul Ruth gets wind of any of this, you got to kill him. Vale and Kim are choppered in. They're given injections of ephemeral as soon as they arrive at CONSEC, I guess to protect the CONSEC employees. So they're set up with two interrogation rooms, and Keller takes the one that Kim is in. And this is what Revick had said this earlier. He says, you better take the room that's the informant, just to be sure. Paul Ruth interrogates Cameron in the other room. As soon as they enter the room, Ruth says, I'm not really sure who to trust around here, so just to be sure, the injections of ephemeral that you and Kim got when you got in were fake, so you both have your powers, and you know if she's in trouble next door, she'll be able to protect herself. Now, a little exposition we get. Vale says, I found Revic working at this place called Bicarbon Amalgamated, and we find out that Dr. Ruth founded the company, and he sold it to Consec years later. Vale tells Ruth that, you know, well, Revic's controlling it now, and he's manufacturing ephemeral in bulk. It's being shipped all over the world and all over the country. The information about where is locked up in the computer. Ruth realize that there must be a mole at Consec. What Paul tells him is that Vale, he said, look, the computer is another nervous system. You can access it. You can scan the computer by joining your nervous systems, which is another cool idea, you know. Again, it's another, you know, scanners being a technique, you know, they keep using it in the film. It's not just some, you know, bullshit device. Some thought was put into it. And it actually is part of the story about how certain information is gleaned and, you know, how the story moves forward in certain ways. And I really appreciate that. We cut to the room next door where Keller is interrogating Kim. And basically he shuts the video off and he's going to kill her. But she still has her scanning power, so she incapacitates him and runs. And he sounds the alarm, which puts the whole place on alert. Then there's a weird scene where Ruth is sitting alone in the room because Cameron Vale has run off to try to find Kim. And he's talking out loud to himself. We get the sense that he knows about Project RIPE. And he's saying it out loud. You know, RIPE is, it was a mistake the first time it happened, and now it must be destroyed. And of course, as he's saying that, Keller's just running by the interrogation room, and he hears him talking to himself. And of course, Revic's orders were to kill her. If Ruth finds out anything about this, you got to kill him. So it's a little too, I don't know, it's a little too pat. It's a little too coincidental, but the rules are the rules of the film. And Keller kills him. But it's a wonky scene. Somehow, Cameron senses Paul Ruth's death. Well, as you're watching the film the first time, you're like, that's ridiculous. But believe it or not, they actually do explain that later on. And then in another shot, Kim and Vale meet up with each other, and they're immediately confronted by armed guards. And it's a neat shot because they come at Kim and Cameron from opposite sides. So Cameron looks at one, she looks at the other. They take control of them. And you see Kim use another scanning technique where the guard thinks that he's holding a gun on his mother, you know, and so he freaks out and he starts crying and apologizes and he cringes and goes down. And we see Cameron's guard do the same, although we don't know exactly what has happened. They actually escape from the facility. Then we see Vale and Kim on the run in a car, and they realize that they can access the computer via a modem line. Cameron can, you know, meld his nervous system with it. They pull into a gas station. Cameron gets into a phone booth, and he, you know, dials. I guess, I don't know how he knows the number, but he knows it. And so then he connects to the computer. But the next shot is then of the Consec computer room, and we have Keller and the tech talking about Project RIPE. And even the tech says, you know, this project file is so deep and so protected that even we can't get into it. And obviously Revic has protected it extremely well that even Keller can't get into it. And then from across the room, another one of the computer guys says, hey, you know, someone's accessing that same record, and they've actually gotten in. And so they pull up the record on the machine, and both Keller and the tech look, and we see all this data streaming, and it's all these dates and names and doctors. And he takes a moment, realizes that it's Vale who's accessing this information. And he has this idea, since their nervous systems are joined, that if he blows up the computer, he may damage or even kill Cameron, who's connected to it in this, you know, as he's scanning it. So the tech will not do it. He's like, you know, I'm going to need some authorization. Keller pulls a gun on him. And basically, you know, they do a few things and they set the auto-destruct. It blows up and you see Vale take a hit and he's in the phone booth, but he shrugs it off and then he gets extremely angry. And then his blowback sort of blows up the entire computer room and winds up killing Keller. And his you know, the power coming out of him is so vast that, you know, he cuts a power line and the phone actually starts to melt in his hand. The phone melting is a really cool scene. It's a really cool effect. You don't see it coming all of a sudden, but you know, he's just, you know, his scanning technique is just off the charts. And then because he caught a power line and they're near a gas station, obviously you can tell what's going to happen next. Power line ignites the gas, and there are these huge explosions that happen, and then he and Kim take off. So next, we're with Kim and Cameron, and they are traveling to this medical clinic, and they enter the clinic, and Kim sits in the waiting room while Cameron goes off to find the doctor. And as she's sitting in the waiting room, she's looking at this pregnant woman, and we hear the music cue, and we hear the sound design come up, and we realize that she's being scanned, and her nose starts to bleed, and the film shows us that it's the unborn child of the pregnant woman that's scanning Kim. It's a creepy scene, really cool. You know, again, the plot thickens in a real neat way. And then Vale finds the doctor, and he basically says, you know, what are you doing with this drug? What is this about? And the doctor sort of like, you know, pleads, you know, ignorance, obviously. Then Cameron comes back out, and he sees that Kim's been scanned, and he's like, what the hell happened? And she explains it, like, that her unborn child has scanned me. Then they realize that ephemeral creates scanners, that the injection into, you know, pregnant women actually creates these little guys. And you'll get that confirmation now as we move into the last act. So as they enter the clinic, Revick is there, and he shoots both he and Kim with these darts, and they pass out. When Vale awakens, he is actually on the couch in Daryl Revick's office, and we are at the end game of this film. And Revick seems very unconcerned and, you know, not really worried about what Cameron's going to do. And we get the revelation that Vale and Revick are brothers, and that Paul Ruth was their father, and that Ruth knew about him his whole life, and Ruth kept an eye on him as he stumbled around in the dark, waiting for the day when he would bring him in to sort of send him against Revick. We get our big exposition of the how this film got started. In the 1930s, Dr. Paul Ruth, you know, discovered this new drug called ephemeral, and it was marketed to pregnant women as a sort of sedative while they were pregnant to keep them calm. But it had one weird side effect, in that it actually created scanners out of their babies. The children were born with these telekinetic abilities. And what we find out is that Ruth gave his pregnant wife sort of the prototype of the drug. And I believe then we get the sense that him and their fraternal twins at some point, and they're not obviously identical twins, but 4 years before the drug came to market, the prototype, which was a more powerful version of it, was given to Ruth's wife. And so these two brothers were born, and they're the two oldest and most powerful scanners. First of all, we realize that when Ruth died, why Cameron felt it, because as a scanner and as Paul as his father, there was some definite connection there. We also realize that Daryl's been looking for him. And why, you know, because at first when we get these tossed away lines that Revick's been looking for Vale, we're just like, it sounds like chosen one bullshit to me. But obviously he's known about him his whole life, and he knows that this is the other strongest scanner in the world. I got to either find this guy, either turn him or kill him. We get all that. And then Revick realizes that Cameron is not interested in joining him and that he's going to take him down. And they get into this final epic scanner duel. And it's really creepy. And what Revick says is, we get an idea of additional scanning techniques. He's like, I'm going to suck your brain and your whole identity out of your body and take it as part of my own. So, you know, you're going to be with me one way or the other. Again, a new scanner technique that we haven't heard of before. So they're going at it. Mostly what we see are these blood vessels, the creepy effects of these blood vessels popping out to their surface. And I think a lot of people probably think they look cokey and goofy, but there's something creepy and really good about them. I don't know. I really like it. You see the blood vessels popping in Cameron's arms. You see them going across Revick's face, and it's just really, really goofy. And then at one point, Cameron's heart just bleeds out through his chest, and you realize he's losing it. Cameron starts to really come apart. His face is bleeding. You know, chunks of his flesh are coming out. And at the same time, the soundtrack and the music is winding up. Really, the music really makes these scanner battles very intense. Otherwise, you know, it's two guys sitting next to each other twitching, right? You have to do something to make it appear dramatic. So Cameron's just a bloody mess. He's bleeding out. He's bleeding out. And then at some point, his eyes just blow out completely. And at that point, Revick's eyes gloss over white, and some apotheosis has happened. And then Cameron starts to combust. The palms of his hands light up, and then his body, he completely lights on fire. There's this crazy moment when Revick is white-eyed and screaming, and then we cut away. So we don't know really exactly what happened. And next, we're from Kim's point of view. She wakes up and goes into the next room, and she sees a burnt corpse on the floor, and it's actually very, very cool, real effects. Like, it's not CGI, right? It looks real. It looks completely desiccated. You can't tell, you know, we can't really tell whose it is, but we've seen it, and we know it's Cameron's, obviously. She hears Cameron, you know, scanning to her, and she turns around, and there's this person hiding under a coat in the corner, and the head pops up, and it's Darryl Revick's head, with one noticeable thing. He has the blue eyes of Cameron, and the scar's missing from the middle of his forehead. And then we hear sort of Cameron and Revick's voice kind of blended together, and he's saying, "Kim, it's me. It's Cameron, you know. We made it. I won." And the camera focuses really in on his eyes, and he cuts away. And, you know, you don't get the sense that he won. You're not really sure, really, what has happened. And the way the film has been shot, where who really won inside there and who's using whose voice to what effect. It's a very ambiguous ending, which is kind of cool. And then you're out, and then you're into credits. Now, my basic overview of this film, I really like it. It's a classic B-movie. What I love about it, too, is that it's lean and mean. Like, this movie is so economically done. Every shot leads into the next shot, leads into the next shot. Everything serves the story. It's incredibly efficiently told. Like, you're in this movie. You know, if you're not thrown out of the movie by anything the movie's doing and you're really into it, the story just moves from one part to the other, each leading logically to the next, without a lot of things that would throw you out in terms of, you know, how certain things happened in the story. And it's just great. I mean, in that way, it's just, I think it's put together extremely tightly. The main actor, as I've said before, this guy, Stephen Lack, really awful. Unfortunately, the film has to center around him. McGoohan is Paul Ruth, and Michael Ironside is really good. And, you know, all the support acting is really, really solid and really good. So, the film to me is just really this great, tight B-movie that I like a lot. And, you know, the themes in terms of being inside someone's head and that these scanners are, like, helpless to drown out these voices, you know, really resonates with me anyway. It really definitely has resonance in the real world in terms of how one lives their life and, you know, as a human being, emotionally, how you deal with your feelings, maybe not so much voices, right? That's the metaphor. The film, it's voices, but for us, it's emotions. And how a lot of people, you know, use substances to escape their feelings for, you know, long periods of time because they don't know how to deal with them. And I feel like that's a really cool thematically way to show it, in that it would be actually literally voices in your head from other people. So that part's really cool. I really like that a lot. And the notion that Cameron finally hears his own voice for the first time when those voices have been drowned out. And it's cool. Very cool as well. So this is definitely one of my favorite horror films for sure. I watch it, you know, every couple of years. I put it back on. And I really dig it. I'd actually be hungry for someone to remake this. I think there's such meat there, on a lot of meat on the bones of this film for a remake. Briefly, I'll run down sort of the franchise that Scanners spawned. So 10 years after Scanners was released, 1991, they released Scanners 2, The New Order. 1991, Scanners 2. 1992, Scanners 3, The Takeover. And Cronenberg, I think, had nothing to do with any of these movies. He maybe needed some cash, so he licensed the sequels. 1994, Scanner Cop. And then 1995, Scanners The Showdown, also known as Scanner Cop 2. And I tried to watch, I think, one or two of these, and they're abysmally bad. I could see why there are sequels, because there's such potential for story in the Scanners concept. Other than the Scanners movie, you know, there's really nothing else dealing with it. I could see it being a TV series. I could see it being a rebooted film franchise. As of now, in January 2015, nada. I don't think anything's even in development for Scanners, so at this point. So that's this week's episode of Sci-Fi on Screen. Yeah, my name is Jeff Palermo, and thanks for listening. You can find us on iTunes and on mobile devices by simply finding, you know, whatever podcast app you have, type in Sci-Fi on Screen. You can subscribe and, you know, get each week's new episode as it downloads. You can also find us at scifionscreen.com. We're on Facebook. And would love any comments and feedback you might have. You could log into the Facebook page, or you could email me directly, scifionscreen@gmail.com. So thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.